Thanks, Billy. Billy asked me to speak maybe a couple months ago, and at the time it seemed like a wonderful idea because it was way in the distance, and now it's right here. So, but really, I do appreciate the opportunity to speak. My sponsor told me that whenever I'm asked to do anything in AA, that I always say yes, and so that's what I did. And it's a great opportunity to be of service in AA. My name is Andy, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 21st, 2007. I have a sponsor, as Billy said, and I'm a member of a home group, and it's the Common Solution Group in Charlottesville, Virginia. We meet on Thursdays at 7:30, and if you're ever in the area, we'd love to see you. It's at the Hinton Avenue Methodist Church. I think that's right now. Well, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about my story, what it was like for me, what it's like today, and what the program has meant to me. I grew up in Fairfax County, Virginia. Had a really good childhood. I hear a lot of stories in AA, and a lot of people describe, you know, something of a nightmare of a childhood. But, you know, I really I had a great family, loving family that gave me whatever I needed, and I don't have any complaints there. So I feel very lucky about that. Growing up, I was, I felt very like an introverted kid. But I always seemed to have a lot of friends and things like that. I know my mom would always describe me as very outgoing. And because she saw me with a bunch of people. But, you know, initially, when I would meet someone that I didn't know very well, I would be very standoffish, very nervous. It was very hard to get to know anyone. The example that I always think of is like when someone would call, let's say a family member, to call the house, you know, maybe on a birthday to talk to everyone in our house. And I'd hear the phone ring, and I might hear my mom start to talk to my grandmother or something. You know, I would just get terrified that I was going to have to talk to her, and I'd run and hide maybe in a closet or something. So, you know, I wouldn't have to get on the phone and actually talk to my grandmother, so, you know, some other adult friend, you know, that I didn't really know. I think maybe that's kind of normal, but, you know, I kind of had that feeling, you know, in high school, you know what I mean? Like all the way growing up, it was still stuck with me. I was just really afraid of things that I didn't know really well, and people I didn't know closely. I think what that I've found out in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think what that comes from is that, you know, I'm a very self-centered person. I found this out through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm very nervous around people if I don't know how you perceive me, if I don't know how I am in your eyes. It's very important for me to for a lot of people to think of me as super terrific, A-OK, number one. And if I don't know that's how you feel about me, you know, I just get in my shell and I'm very nervous. But once I can get past that with people and friends, you know, I can really be around people and be very comfortable. So growing up, you know, that was kind of how I felt about myself, I guess. Drinking kind of started for me just a little bit in high school. I drank with friends just because it was kind of cool. It was bad, and that was fun. But it didn't. I don't remember the first drink I had. It wasn't a big aha. This is everything. You know, that didn't really occur when I was growing up in high school. But you know, I just hung out with some kids, did that kind of thing. But where drinking, I think, really took off for me is once I got to college. You know, growing up in high school, you surround yourself with a lot of people you know. You have a lot of the core group of friends, very comfortable with them. Then when I got to college, you know, all of a sudden now, it was a whole new social environment. I went to UVA here in Charlottesville, down the road. And, you know, initially started going out, I went to some fraternity parties and things like this. And really the whole point, I think, there initially is you kind of put yourself on display. And you go to these different places and you meet people and you find out, do they like you? You know, what do they think about me? And this was really everything that was really difficult for me and hard for me to deal with. It was really uncomfortable. And this is where I started to realize, hey, the great thing about all of these parties and all these events is that they serve alcohol. And they serve a lot of alcohol. And they never seem to run out of it. So I started, you know, with my friends using alcohol in these types of situations, and I found that this it was just absolutely perfect. You know, the nervousness, the anxiety about what you thought about me was just totally gone, and I was able to be completely comfortable. You know, speaking to girls and speaking to guys, I think the biggest part for me was really interacting with other men. And this is one thing that I heard Clancy say one time at, I guess, Pockets of Enthusiasm, was that alcohol makes him feel the way men looked. And I think that that was exactly what it, when I heard him say that, I realized that's what alcohol does for me. Because I don't believe that I knew what it meant to be a man. I didn't know how to make the right decision all the time. You know, when I'm put in a weird situation, if I don't know a group of people, or if maybe something's going wrong, I'm anxious, you know. But when I had that alcohol in me, it was cool. I could not only intuitively think I'm making the right decision, it might be a stupid decision, but it felt like the right decision. But I felt good about it, you know, and I was calm. And number one, it was like the whole situation with the whole group of people as a social environment was really smoothed over. And, you know, in that aspect, alcohol was fantastic for me during those years of going to college, because it allowed me to get out of my little group of me, really, and meet some other people and interact with them. And it wasn't all great, obviously, because here I am. But, you know, eventually I started drinking more and more, and the quantities got more and more. And I think I got a lot of pride about the amount that I could drink, you know. You got these fraternity situations where you have contests and you do stupid things. And you know, at some point, when I consistently drank, it just began to take over, and it just began to be a part of life. I got to the third year of college, and you know, as I got more involved in the social arrangements, social scenes, actual school itself and learning kind of began to take a back seat. And eventually I got the letter from UVA that said, Mr. Lofton, we're going to need you to take a year off because you haven't been going to classes, and we just recommend you take a year off. So at that point, I really had nothing to do but to say yes to that, because they were in charge. I asked my parents. I actually didn't ask my parents, I guess. I just went back home and lived with my parents for a year. And now this, I guess, is maybe the first concrete example of where I can see that my drinking has really put a large burden on the people I love, specifically my parents. I was the third child, and my parents had, you know, sent me off to college. And I think they thought, you know, they were done with rearing children at this point. But then, you know, 2 years later, here I am back again. And, of course, they have to put everything on hold. I'm back in my old bedroom. You know, Mom's making dinner and doing the dishes and cleaning the clothes again. And I didn't even think for a second at that time that, you know, maybe I'm putting, you know, I just expected that they would do this to me, and I wasn't thinking about from their point of view. So I stayed there for a year. You know, and I think, you know, the university let me get back into college that next year, and I finished up. So in my mind at that time, I thought, okay, it's really stunk that I had to take a year off, but, you know, it's not a big deal. You know, I didn't lose anything. I'm still going to get a degree. Everything's fine. It's okay. I kind of skated by. Now, other repercussions started to pop up, I think, during that time. One thing that happened is, this one story I tell sometimes is that a few buddies of mine, sometimes we used to go on these spring break trips. We'd all pile into a car, pick a direction, and drive. And we'd get to a college town, and we'd call up some buddy that maybe we went to high school with and just say, hey, we're in town, put us up for the night. And this kind of thing, we usually would raise hell, and then before the smoke even cleared the next morning, we'd just get the hell out of there. So we were doing this one time, going south, and went through Nashville, and ended up going to some karaoke bars or something. And walking back into this sorority house where we were going to spend the night. And we ended up walking through the baseball field at Vanderbilt University, and we saw this beautiful golf cart that they used to take, like, injured people off of the field. So we went over just to make sure that it was locked down and that maybe they didn't leave the keys in it, but they had. So we fired it up and started driving it around and did the bases, you know, timed the base paths a little bit. Then kind of went out a little bit further, did the outfield, and my friend noticed that the lock to center field that opened the gate out, you know, was open. So, of course, we did a little road test. Went, you know, streets of Nashville, just cruising around. And it was awesome. It felt fantastic. And, you know, at one point, you know, we decided, oh, well, let's call it a night. Let's be responsible here. And then, so we left and started walking back. And we didn't get about two blocks before a police car pulled around and, you know, threw us on the ground and cuffed us. And we found out that the value of this golf cart that we had, the police officer said, stolen. We argued that we didn't steal it, but, you know, made this offense a felony. And he took us into, you know, arrested us, took us into prison, where we spent a night. And, you know, it was kind of a wake-up call for me at the time. I remember thinking, you know, this is awful. If I get out of this, I need to remember how bad this is so I never end up here again. Just so happened that a family member knew the dean of the university at Vanderbilt and was able to pull some strings with the mayor's office, and we got out. And we got out on, you know, we just had to do some community service. And so once again, this is another example where we're extremely stupid, abused people around us and things around us. But again, we're leaving, you know, wiping our hands off thinking, hey, we're getting away scot-free. You know, no real consequences. And again, I think what I overlooked here is what this did to my parents. You know, it's extremely embarrassing, you know, to have my dad call a friend of his to get his son out of jail for doing something, you know, being drunk. And I'm not even sure if my parents knew what state I was in at the time before they got the call at like 4 a.m. And at that, you know, for a few more years, I didn't even realize what that must have done to them. Just the embarrassment and the shame. So, you know, this other big thing behind me that I just dodged, you know, I was able to, in my head, just move on from. That fourth year of college, then after I was back, you know, I had worked for a year while during the year that I was off, which should have been my fourth year. My sister worked for a defense contractor in Crystal City, Virginia, and during that year she was super nice to me, and what she did was hooked me up with a job. She figured if I had that year off school, I don't want him sitting around here on his hands. So she went out on a limb and got me this job, pretty much. And actually, I didn't even realize this until maybe like, I don't know, probably when I was doing the amends process in this program is really what it had caused my sister during this year to really put her neck out to get me this job. Because the entire time that I was working for this company, same company my sister worked for, you know, I really abused the position. My drinking was getting totally out of control, living at home with my parents. Every day I got off work, I'd go straight to a bar, and I'd sit, I almost went to the same bar in this little shopping center, and I'd sit next to about four or five people that were there every day. And they were, you know, between the ages of 25 and 55, four or five people, and I'd see the same faces every day. And every day when I was leaving, I was like, man, I can't believe those alcoholics come to the same bar every day. And I'd be leaving there thinking, oh, it's almost depressing, you know, that these people have to do that. And meanwhile, I just, blinders up, this isn't me, I'm not an alcoholic. But I come home, you know, not really do anything, not much communication with my parents. Next day, get up to go to work, you know, hungover, stinking terribly, being around the same supervisors that my sister has. The same supervisors that my sister asked to give me this position. And I mean, I'm sure I just reeked like a brewery every day. I'm sure all these things happen. But, you know, I just kept skating by. And at one point, I got moved to this an actual naval facility in Washington, D.C., the Navy Yard. And it was this massive facility that they had built. And at that time, only about 10% of it was filled with actual people. They were slowly phasing in government contractors in. So I'd go and I'd check in, you know, walk through the metal detector, little badge, and I'd walk, and I'd be so hungover I couldn't think. And what I would do is I'd find some wing of this huge complex that was still vacant, and it just had empty cubicles where, like, over the next year they were going to slowly phase in workers. And I would just find this distant desk somewhere and just crawl underneath it and just sleep for, you know, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. And as soon as I could sleep off whatever awful feeling I have, I would get up and then make my way to my real little cubicle and do my work. And, you know, this was just really embarrassing. And, again, I didn't hear anything about it specifically, but looking back on it, I know it must have been easy to tell that this person's abusing, you know, some privileges. But anyway, that's what's really neat about this program is things like that. You know, I really didn't even realize until going through this program. But some more consequences that I ran into. After I graduated, I stayed in town, and I was dating a woman who's now my wife, who's here today, and I appreciate her coming. Hi, Sarah. Makes it a little bit more nerve-wracking, but that's okay. So I had this, I guess I should say this fourth year I'm still at school, my now wife was working out in Gordonsville and lived in a little log cabin. We lived in this cabin together. And about this time, you know, a lot of my friends that I'd gone to school with those first 3 years, you know, they had graduated and moved on. So now I was doing this thing, and I was treating it just like I had treated my job when I was living with my parents. I got up, I made it there, I did my thing, and as soon as the bell rang, I'm done. It's decompression time, and it's alcohol. And so for me, what that meant is I usually, on the way back out to the cabin, about a half an hour outside of town, I would stop at usually the same little gas station and buy a two 22-ounce bottles of beer. And at that time, you know, it was no big deal, and I was just drinking. And so I usually would get through both by the time I got home. And, you know, shortly after that, I guess my wife would, now my wife, thank God, my girlfriend at the time would come home. And, you know, I didn't realize, but every time, you know, she would come home and I had been drinking, you know, I really wasn't myself. I couldn't offer anything to the relationship. I was terrible around the house. You know, I didn't do anything. And I don't mean to say these things like now I'm perfect around the house, because she will tell you I'm not. But at that time, you know, I really couldn't contribute the way that a partner should in a relationship. You know, I was stealing something from the relationship at that time, too. And this habit of drinking and this decompression, this almost like medication habit that I had gotten into, you know, it just became stronger and stronger. I eventually graduated and I got a job in town in Charlottesville. And, you know, this is when now my girlfriend and I, now my wife, you know, we were both working, and so it was a household. We had, you know, two working adults, and now I had a real excuse, I think, in my head to maybe get drunk at the end of the day, because I put in what I might call a hard day's work, although I doubt it deserved or it warranted the drinking. But we began to butt heads about the drinking a little bit, and I began to develop some sneaky habits, you know, hiding bottles in certain places, getting creative about how I lifted bottles out of the fridge with my fingers spread so that it clinked together so you couldn't hear them. And I think probably the saddest thing is just waiting until she would go to bed and the door would shut, and the light would go off. And so then I could really drink how I wanted to drink. You know, just really get it done. Excuse me. So, anyway. So during that period, you know, I'd come up with a lot of excuses to get us apart and get us separate so I could drink the way I wanted to drink. I'd usually do it outside in the dark. Pack of cigarettes and some beer or whatever it took. And I think it's just a really empty period in my life at that time. I had no reason to do this. I could have looked at the value of what I was doing and what I was giving up. And it made no sense. But for some reason, I just kept doing it. So eventually, things were deteriorating in the relationship, as well as there were repercussions with the job that I was facing, and that I wasn't performing as well as I knew I could. And I think the big thing was as well as my employers knew I could. And things started getting really, really bad, and I was at the end of my rope, and I think I got to the point where I think what it really was is I need to save this marriage. It wasn't really about I need to quit drinking. It wasn't really about I need to fix a lot of this damage that I've done in my life to everyone I know. It was really I need to get her off my back, maybe. And so I heard about Alcoholics Anonymous, and so I called up and I found a meeting. Went to a meeting in Charlottesville, and I think that, you know, I thought that maybe I can fix myself now. I can figure this out. I can take some tools and do some things. I had this attitude going in that I really was just going to take what this had and get what I needed out of it, which come to find out months later is that was really, I think, the source of my problem the whole time. Early on, I started going to a few of the same meetings in Charlottesville. I heard from a lot of the same faces that I saw all the time to do some things. And they said to go to, you know, 4 or 5 meetings a week. They said, get a sponsor early. And, of course, initially I was like, woo, you know, maybe that's for the alcoholics. You know, I'm here. I have a drinking problem. But the more and more I went to these meetings, the more and more I listened to the people around me, I started, bulbs started going off above my head. I started hearing familiar things, especially with the way people would describe the way they actually drank and the way that they felt, and drinking to oblivion, and blackouts, and how they would occur almost every time they drank, not remembering going to bed for a week, you know, every night. Things like that would echo in my head, and I'd say, well, maybe I am in the right place. You know, maybe I need to think about these things. And, you know, and looking at the first step, right, that we're powerless over alcohol, our lives have become unmanageable. My life was unmanageable. That's why I came to my first meeting. No problem. Powerless over alcohol, that's what took some work, okay, and that's where I had to get to the point to really say out loud to other people and honestly believe that I'm an alcoholic. But I feel really fortunate that I got tied in with some of the people that I did in Charlottesville and that really spoke honestly to me. I think what the most amazing thing was, and probably what drew me back initially, was the honesty that I heard in the rooms of AA. Because nowhere else have I heard people talk really honestly, open up and tell you exactly what's going on with them and what went on with them. Before I got a sponsor, I kept going to these meetings, like I said, and I think I was talking to one guy after the meeting, and I laid on him thick the woes of my life at the time, and my relationship, and how it might be going, and I don't know what I should do next, what's my next step? You know, the tears might have been coming. And he looked at me and he said, AA's not marriage counseling. You come here to get sober, and that's it. And I was like, well, this knucklehead, he's... this guy is really crazy. So I actually asked him to be my sponsor, I think, the next week. But, you know, and the guy that I asked to be my sponsor, you know, I thought about it. Really early on, I identified with what he had said at the meetings I was at, but I really shied away from asking him to be my sponsor because he was serious, you know what I mean? I mean, he was punctual. He was always at meetings. He was really involved. And I knew that if I got tied in with someone like that, I would have to be punctual, and I would have to show up. I'd have to dress appropriately. You know, I would have to do a lot of things that I didn't want to do. And so I don't know what specifically changed to to make me go that direction, but it did, and I'm glad that it happened that way. So my sponsor early on set down a list of requirements for me. He said, I need you to go to 4 to 5 meetings a week. You need to join the home group, which was easy because I had already joined the Common Solution group. And I need you to call 2 or 3 alcoholics every day on the phone. And that last thing, calling people on the phone, that was really difficult because I'm not really a phone person. I do the thing where when they're talking, I talk, and then silence for like 5 seconds. It's really awkward. And sometimes I just don't, you know, I might not have anything to say. And, you know, I found out from him that that's okay. We just need to get out there and call these other people because you have no idea when the person you're calling might just need someone to talk to. They might have something on their mind. And if you just give them the ring, you're of service to them automatically if they need it. And, you know, it's good practice for talking on the phone. You know, someday if I have a sponsee, you know, I just might need to know how to talk to another alcoholic and to hear their problems. I mentioned the clothing thing before, too. This was also an issue I had had. I didn't think it was an issue at the time. But I found out, I remember coming into a meeting, and I don't know if I was wearing, I might have just been wearing an actual bathing suit and a t-shirt or something at the time, and it was wearing it in my home group. And I remember my sponsor came up to me, and he just told me, you know, we don't dress like this here. It's like, you know, you come, you know, dress appropriately or don't come to the home group. And I remember, I think I just turned and stormed out. And, you know, the next time I went to the meeting, I was wearing my pants, and I had on a shirt. And, I mean, wearing a shirt, I think I could do that. So it's just one of those things where I just needed to swallow it a little bit and to just learn to take direction from other people. Because I wasn't good at doing that. And so slowly I took these directions one at a time. And I think now, looking back on it, what that meant is that I really wasn't running the show anymore for me. Not all of it. You know, I was giving up a lot of things, and I was just taking advice from other people and really following the path that they laid out for me. And that's what I needed, because clearly I can't do it on my own. I had failed over and over again trying to run the show. The next step for me that obviously would follow one would be two. But the second step, initially, the God thing really scared me. And it was something that I grew up in a Catholic household, and I still called myself a Catholic, perhaps, but I really didn't want to buy into a God thing for some reason. You know, it was something I put up in my head that I don't want to, I don't know, I shied away from it. And I realized that in AA, what I was doing is I was kind of putting another wall between myself and the program. Maybe deep down I knew that I was willing to believe anything because I was really done with everything at that point. But it was another hurdle that I was putting up in front of myself to kind of separate me from everyone else. But in going through the steps, you know, I worked very closely with my sponsor. And this was something that he made very clear to me that I think was really helpful. And it could be helpful to others that maybe are struggle with the God and believing in a higher power. It was at that point, you know, he said that, you know, how long have you been sober now? And perhaps it was like 3 months maybe at that time. And he said, could you have done that on your own? And I said, no. And he said, you know, do you think it's power greater than you, and that it's the people in Alcoholics Anonymous have helped you do that? You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole, in the fellowship? I said, yeah, I think that's probably due to it. And he said, well, that's power greater than yourself. Let's move on. And it was that simple. And for me, you know, that simplicity in looking at this stuff, that simply is the only way that I was able to move through these things. Because I could sit here and argue a point, and I could argue myself right out of these rooms over and over if I let myself. But that, nobody wins. Then I'm just driving the show again, and that's what got me here in the first place. So, you know, it just took taking these directions, being open-minded, and keeping it extremely simple that made it work so far. You know, another thing that I think that I learned from my sponsor and also a lot of the guys in my home group. We're a pretty close home group. We do a lot of things together. It's just the idea of service and the idea of being available to other people. And number one, being where you say you're going to be when you say you're going to be there. A guy in my home group told me once that you don't know when you're going to be helpful to someone. And in fact, the times that people are really helpful to you, they don't realize that they're being helpful to you. And I mean, that spoke a lot for me. And that just made me think that, you know, going to meetings, just listening to someone, maybe just a nod of a head or just a response you give, might be really helpful, might be exactly what that person needs. And that couldn't have happened if I hadn't shown up and I hadn't been there and just been willing to give. And getting a job in a home group. You know, I started, I'm sure I made coffee, cleaned up coffee, and now I'm the secretary in our home group. We have a neat little website, which kind of gets out of control sometimes, but it's fun. And I just always try to stay involved in our group, and I think that's something really good about our home group, is we encourage everyone to get a position. Moving on through the steps and working with my sponsor, when I got to the fourth step, I think this is probably the point in since I got sober where I really learned the most about myself. And what I found out was that when I went through all of the resentments that I laid out on my table, I learned that really they all came from, almost all came from exactly the same source, and that's just, you know, fear of self-esteem and fear of what other people think about me. And, you know, a grudge I might hold against someone might be surely because, or solely because if I give in and I say that I'm wrong, you know, it'll make me look wrong. And that was unacceptable. And resentment after resentment followed this same pattern. And it was that I couldn't give up these things because of how I perceived how it would make me look to you. And those same resentments are the same kind that pop up today. But the difference today is that I know exactly why I feel that way. And I have tools now, you know, to deal with them. And one thing I don't do is I don't let them build and build and build for years and years. And I don't try not to let them affect the way I you know, carry out my business. And this also really, moving into the fourth step and sharing all of these harms that I had, confessing to my sponsor, you know, it got me one step closer to the amends process, which was really terrifying for me. Before I came into AA, there was one thing I knew about it. You don't drink, and that you have to make amends. And there are a few things that I had done in my life, maybe one specifically, that I can clearly remember sitting on my bed at home and saying, I lied, I'm going to lie, and this is what I'm going to take to my grave. And I had a conscious decision about that. So I knew from that first meeting, I said, oh man, you know, better be careful because I might have to make amends for this. You know, this might come up. And so going through that fourth step and seeing things come up and then talking about it with my sponsor, you know, got me one step there, one step closer. And I guess I thought that, you know, that would be bad, but it was neat that after the fifth step and sharing it with my sponsor, I did have a little glimpse of hope and a little glimpse of what it might be like to actually right that wrong or do as much as I could to right it and fix that, clean up my side of the street. And it felt good. But again, that's just one small step on the way through the amends process. And that's another thing that I just think is really cool about this program. And that when I was going through the amends process with my parents, you know, after we did that, you know, they had some questions for me. And a big concern that I had was that they thought that this was a chance for me to get in with a group of people and bitch about your parents and how awful it was growing up and things like that. I told both my parents that, you know, that's really not what this is. And, you know, I don't think they had that concept anyway going in, but I just wanted to make sure that, because maybe that's what I thought it was supposed to be. I don't know. Yeah, doing that ninth step is just really cool to me. I think I just like that what this program is about figuring out the mess you got on your side of the street and then getting it sorted out and just cleaning that stuff up. And not worrying about what other people are doing over here. All I can do, that's none of my business. You know, all I can do over here is just get my stuff straight and act on that going forward. Because, you know, I still am this way, but I was before, but just really concerned about what other people are doing. You know, when I see people doing bad things and doing things wrong, you know, it can really get me going, you know, but it shouldn't. And the things that I've learned in this program is seeing the way people respond to the examples that other people set. And the way a lot of people give direction sometimes just through action and through example. And how that's so much more powerful than someone standing up at a podium here like this and telling you something. When you see someone do something over and over again, you see it with your own eyes, and you see that they're an alcoholic and they're able to do these things, you know, that's really powerful and it speaks volumes. You know, people, you know, I had trouble, you know, I work from home now, and I don't have a commute. I can kind of make my own schedule. A lot of things going on, you know, that make life easier, but I can still think about things to complain about. And then I'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll see a single mother or, you know, a father, and they're dealing with all kinds of things, and maybe they're sponsoring five or six guys, you know, on the phone all day with people, working late, and they're not complaining about anything. To me, like, that's the example that I get a lot from. Also had an experience in the ninth step with, I guess I should talk a little bit about making amends to my parents. I mentioned a couple of the things that I had gone through maybe in that year off of school, but there are a list of things that I'm sure a lot of people have and need to make amends for. And the process, you know, I was pretty nervous about, because for me it was the first time that I really had to present myself as an alcoholic to my close family and to really present, you know, they got a glimpse of the program and what it meant for me. So it was really helpful to work closely with a sponsor to prepare for this and other people in my home group to gain from their experience. Going into the amends with my parents, my sponsor made a little check sheet or a list for me, maybe like six or seven steps. And number one was call sponsor. Number two was pray. Then went through steps of the amends. And then the last one was call sponsor. And I remember when I went home for one weekend to do this and with my parents, and it wasn't going the way I wanted it to go, and the timing-wise, I couldn't get them to be in the right place at the right time. I didn't feel right. This, and I don't feel comfortable here. And again, it was becoming all about me, and I didn't realize it. And I remember calling my sponsor and asking him, and you know, he made it very clear to me that this isn't about you. You know, this is about making it right with them, the wrongs that you've done. And that also means on their schedule and their time frame. And, you know, that kind of was really helpful to me. That cleared it up. And went ahead and ended up doing that. And I think the most powerful thing that came out of that for me was, you know, after I had told specifically my mother, the wrongs that I had done, and when I asked her if I had left anything out, you know, she was ready to go ahead and fill in the blanks. My dad was a little bit more quiet at that point, but I asked my mom, you know, what other ways have I harmed you? And that's when she really opened up. My sponsor had written on my little cheat sheet, which I didn't actually have in front of me at the time, but I had worked on upstairs before. You know, he said, this is when you shut up and you listen. And it's very important that this is the time that you give those who you've harmed the chance to tell you, without your interjection, specifically how else you harmed them. And I think that was the first time I've ever let my mom speak honestly to me without interrupting her, maybe. Because I perceived her totally differently. It was almost like it was just a peer or someone, you know, like a friend of yours, because she was, because I really felt bad for her, you know, like honestly, when she listed a lot of things I hadn't thought about, you know, in ways, you know, that I really, you know, I hadn't thought about. And I realized at that time, you know, how important it is to really listen to people, like in your family that you really care about, that maybe you overlook usually. And the amends afterwards for my mom and ways that I could make it right for her, you know, it just really involved being a son, being present more, calling her more, things like this. That's really what she needed. I had a different result with my dad. My dad was pretty much said, hey, you know, these things happen. We don't worry about stuff in the past. You know, we're cool, whatever. But it was still a good experience for me because it was just a chance for me to be really honest with him and, you know, to put it on the line. But one thing I did get out from, I did learn from him was that he told me he's familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous, that a couple of his uncles, he's from Mississippi, a couple of his uncles in Mississippi had been through the program. And he said he remembered when he was young that they had some, obviously some problems drinking. And that eventually, he said, some guys would come over, and they'd kind of go out in the car together and be gone for a couple hours. They'd hang out, do some things, he'd come home. And that was just his impression of the program. But one thing he said is, you know, those guys have been sober for, you know, since then. And so, you know, 40-plus years. And so that meant a lot to me in that, A, this wasn't a totally foreign concept to my dad specifically. That, A, alcoholism is alive in the family. And even though I was convinced I'm an alcoholic, it made it easier to swallow to know that someone in my family had been through and is going through the same things. And also that Alcoholics Anonymous worked for them and still is working for them. I see it every day in meetings and things, but there's just a whole nother level to it when it's, you know, someone in your family that you didn't even know about that had been through it. So that was really powerful, and that came out of the amends process as well. You know, on a day-to-day basis, I'm thinking about the 10th and 11th step, you know, it seems like recently I've been in a couple meetings talking about 10 and 11, and I'm thinking about, you know, I'm very loose, I'm not very rigid in how I approach this, but one thing that I do know is that when I wake up in the morning and the first thing I think about is Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing I think about is praying, you know, that's a good day. And usually what happens to me is this occurs to me in bed is I'll just say a little prayer to myself before I get out of bed. And it's as simple as, you know, God, show me how to be of service, maximum service today. You know, how can I be helpful today? How can I carry out the actions of my day and be, you know, helpful to those around me? And that happens a whole lot more when the night before, you know, I've gone through a brief inventory of the harms that I created for the day and like I should be doing. But when I'm getting on that rhythm, you know, I notice my days go a lot better. You know, it's not like everything's perfect now, but I just think that it's a lot easier to deal with when you have this routine to go through. And if you can stick to it, for me, when I've been able to stick to it, things go a lot better. You know, early on in Alcoholics Anonymous, the idea of staying in the program, the idea of not drinking, meant it was going to fix some things for me, but it also meant that I was going to lose a lot of life, a lot of what it meant to live, in my opinion. Because I liked to go out and do a lot of things. I like to see live music. My wife and I go see concerts all the time. And, you know, I thought that early on that would be gone. And early on it was gone. You know, I couldn't be at a bar and I couldn't be around those things. And it was slowly integrated, but you know, now I've learned to just be smart about things and, you know, not cut corners, but long story short, you know, we were able to do some of those things now again. You know, we went to the jazz festival down in New Orleans this year and had a great time. Probably now when we take vacations, you know, it used to be loaded, or I used to just be loaded. But you know what? My vacations, and when I'm spending time alone with my wife now, are so much better than they were before because it's based on honesty. And I didn't think I'd be able to enjoy a vacation or a concert without alcohol, but I can enjoy it so much more. It's amazing, and that's something I didn't believe until it started happening. I didn't believe it was going to happen. I mentioned before a little bit about my home group. This is joining a home group, and the guys that I met in that home group have been such a big part of my sobriety. And just meeting these guys and talking with them during meetings, before meetings, and after meetings have been huge. You know, I mentioned to you before how my sponsor told me that you know, I need to call a couple alcoholics every day. Now, early on, it used to be a drag. I used to try to be like, oh, I got to get this in. It's a chore. I need to do this. It's a burden. Now I found that noon, I might think about it. Oh, I got to call my alcoholics, and I've already spoken to three of them. You know, just because they're my friends now. You know, these are the people that I want to talk to because they're the people that I care about. They're the people. They're my family. So, yeah, I guess what I've found in this program is that, you know, early on, somewhere along it switched for me. Early on, it was about what I could get out of it and what it could do for me. And now it's really just about what's going to keep me sober. It's just trying to give back to everyone else. And it just feeds off of itself. You know, there's about eight guys here from my home group that came up to this meeting. They don't usually do it, and they all piled in the car. You know, that's huge. I feel like I could ask any of these guys to, you know, be there for me. I know they will. They always show up. So, I guess that's about it. Thank you.